From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the East Bay, from Concord.
Fruitvale, East Oakland.
I'm from Milpitas.
Berkeley.
Palo Alto.
I live in North Beach.
Coming up, we're taking you on a tour of Bay Area development from the ground up. First stop, a controversial plant that makes one of the most important ingredients in new construction, cement.
The assumptions that our goal is to pollute on purpose, and that couldn't be further from the truth.
Then we'll meet a unique explorer who visits some of the Bay Area's most underground attractions.
The city's actually really quiet once you go below a certain depth.
And we'll end up deep inside one of San Francisco's biggest ongoing construction projects.
When you're a hole in the ground for 3 years, you celebrate that first piece above ground.
We're talking about holes in the ground, big ones. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. The Bay Area is booming. Since 2010, the region's population has grown at a faster rate than the entire state of California or the U.S. as a whole. All this growth comes with a lot of new construction, and that means we need a lot of cement. Cement is to concrete as flour is to bread. The powdery substance gets mixed with water and sand to form the concrete at the base of many of the Bay Area's bridges, tunnels, and buildings. KALW's Angela Johnston takes us to the local source of that essential ingredient.
Up in the Silicon Valley foothills, there's something that many Bay Area residents don't even know exists. It's deep, it's full of dirt.
It's a very large hole in the ground.
That's Carrie Saragusa, CEO of the Lehigh Southwest Cement Company, just outside Cupertino. And that hole he's talking about is truly very large. It's 650 feet deep and almost a quarter mile wide. The hole is a limestone quarry owned by Lehigh. And all around that hole is a factory that takes the mined limestone and converts it into cement.
We're pulverizing it. We're heating it, and then we pulverize it again, and that's what cement is.
Saragusa drives me all around the 7 square miles of cement plant in his black Jeep, showing me how it's done. It looks like we're on another world, a moonscape, or something from Mad Max. There are piles of gray dirt everywhere, rust-colored equipment and conveyor belts zigzag into domes with limestone deposits attached to them, hanging like dark gray stalactites. There's a 300-foot-tall stack in the middle, and attached to that is a massive metal tube that slowly rotates on its side. Saragusa says when it comes down to it, making cement isn't much different from what you see in the Flintstones.
And all it's doing is turning big rocks into little rocks.
And it's been happening here for a long time.
Henry Kaiser built this plant in 1939, to supply a large dam project at Shasta, Mount Shasta Dam.
Henry Kaiser actually named his health foundation after the creek that runs alongside the quarry. It's called Permanente Creek. Back then, this whole area was orchards and fields.
As you can imagine, in 1939, when this plant was built, there weren't very many houses. Not outside the gate for sure, but not even in the whole South Bay area.
But as Silicon Valley grew, homes and schools and later tech companies started popping up around the quarry. Now there are millions of people who live around the Lehigh plant.
But the neat thing about having it near a metropolitan area is it's very conducive to providing product to the industry that uses us.
Saragusa says Lehigh produces roughly 90% of the cement used in concrete for Bay Area construction projects. The new 49ers stadium used Lehigh cement. So did the new span of the Bay Bridge. As the Bay Area builds more highways, hospitals, and bridges, Lehigh profits. But they also get more neighbors. And many of those neighbors are concerned. Bill Allman lives in Los Altos Hills, only a few miles away from the cement plant. And twice a month, he has to wash his car with vinegar. His silver Toyota Corolla is coated in a very thin layer of limestone dust. You can't tell by looking at it, but if you rub your palm over the paint, it's there.
You can feel it.
Yeah. It won't come off with water.
The dust on Allman's car is actually particulate matter that comes from the blasts in the quarry.
But you also get dust down at the Cupertino side from the cement plant.
Okay.
And you get it also from the trucks.
Other neighbors complain it gets on their windows, the sides of their homes. But a dirty car is actually the least of Bill Allman's worries. There's what the plant is dumping in the creek that runs by his house, and what his neighbors' kids are inhaling when they play outside. Lehi is regularly listed as one of the biggest Bay Area polluters. Allman tries to attend almost every public meeting there is about Lehi.
Yes, we've been pressing the county, the city councils, the air district, the water board, etc. And I would say in the last 5 years, we've made a lot of progress.
And Allman is just one of hundreds of local citizens who keep a very close watch on the plant and its emissions.
And so at night, I will hear this.
Paula Wallace lives in Cupertino, behind the cement plant. And this sound drives her crazy. She calls someone every time she sees or hears of a problem with the cement plant.
Because I want them to know that people are watching.
Unlike some of her neighbors, she's not worried that the plant will give her cancer or her children autism. There isn't enough scientific evidence out there to prove that, she says. But she thinks that Lehi should be held to higher standards.
I mean, they're in our backyard. So if we're going to be neighbors, I want them to be the best neighbors they can be.
So Wallace asks questions. Like Bill Allman, she attends meetings and she watches.
If I watch this facility for not only my neighbors, myself, but also for the people of Cupertino and the larger Bay Area, then somebody else somewhere will take care of that creek that is running by their house and make sure that together we work on the little areas that we can, not taking on the world, but just taking on a small aspect of what we can do to benefit all of us.
But Allman, Wallace, and others are still concerned. One issue is water. Back in April, Lehi was fined $7.5 million by the Environmental Protection Agency for dumping millions of gallons of toxic water into Permanente Creek. That creek flows into the San Francisco Bay. Another big issue is air quality. When the limestone is heated to make cement, chemicals like mercury, ammonia, and dioxins get released into the air. These chemicals can cause cancer and respiratory problems. In September, Lehi made another settlement with the EPA for failing to report these toxic chemical emissions 5 years ago.
We're pretty sure that it's the most controlled cement plant in the nation.
That's Wayne Kino. He's the director of enforcement at the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. They have inspectors out at Lehi at least once a week. But it's not just them. There's the EPA, the Santa Clara Valley Water District, the Department of Environmental Health. Lehi is watched by at least 8 different regulatory agencies.
We make sure the monitors are monitoring accurately. We make sure that the facility is running, in meeting all the standards.
The Air Quality Management District also tests the air around Lehi. They claim that the mercury levels are now at what they call background levels. Harmless, they say. The same concentrations you'd see in national parks. But Kino admits that's all because of citizens like Allman and Wallace.
I think having a passionate community is necessary for this process. And they provide us the ability to be able to go as far as we go. We have the most stringent rules in the world.
These regulatory agencies say they aren't trying to force Lehi out of business. And Saragusa says Lehi isn't trying to pull a fast one on the agencies. But he knows that's not the perception the public has.
The assumptions that our goal is to pollute on purpose, get away with as much as we can, and produce more than we're legally permitted to do. And that couldn't be further from the truth.
Saragusa says people like Paula Wallace and Bill Allman aren't invisible to him. During our tour of the cement plant, I asked him if he knows Bill Allman.
I told him that one of my goals was someday to have him get up in front of the planning commission and basically explain that we were doing a great job. That was my goal, is to someday have him actually get up there. I don't want a pat on the back, but I just have him acknowledge that we're doing the right things.
When I asked Bill Allman what he thought about that.
Do you think that could ever happen?
No, that won't happen. You've got this huge collision coming. We need to build more homes. We need to widen 280. We need to fix transportation. We need to put new schools in, not the current school. We need more schools, and it has to be in a very healthy environment that technology people are willing to work at.
And in the midst of all that, the cement plant keeps growing, supplying the foundations for a population that's grown up around it and isn't going to stop. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Lehigh cement gets used in construction projects all around the Bay Area, but most of us don't actually get to set foot inside those sites until they're finished. That is, unless you're the deputy director of the Bay Area Infrastructure Observatory. That's the position internet entrepreneur Tim Huang created for himself. Huang organizes tours of what he calls the guts of modern life, the power plants and subway tunnels that keep the Bay Area running. KLW's Angela Johnston spoke with Huang about why it's important to get to know our infrastructure.
Why did you decide to start the Infrastructure Observatory?
Well, it started a few years ago. It was actually a really funny story. You know, so I had been trying to get into a nuclear power plant with a couple of friends, and we were trying to take a tour. And so we called them, basically saying, you know, can we take a tour of this nuclear power plant? And they basically said, yeah, we do tours of for schools sometimes and all that, but like, who are you again? And I was like, well, I just like live in the neighborhood. And they were very polite about it, but they effectively said like, no, and why are you calling? And like, you know, you're probably on a list now, and so on and so forth. And so we said, okay, well, we shouldn't let that discourage us. So we put together a really fancy looking logo and a cool website. And I called back a few months later when they had forgotten about us. And when they said, who are you? I said, well, I'm deputy director of the Bay Area Infrastructure Observatory. And they said, well, that's great. Let us know when you want to come by and if there's anything in the plant you want to see. And so we set up our first tour. That was a few years ago now. And it was a ton of fun. And, you know, we started to think, well, if this is what it takes to get access to infrastructure and learn about infrastructure, maybe we can use that to go see other things as well.
What made you want to get inside that power plant? What was your motivation for that?
Well, it's so interesting about infrastructure, you know, because it's sort of everywhere and nowhere at once. You know, so electricity, right, is something that you depend on every single day. But you don't often think that, like, there's a place where the power comes from and there's, like, people whose full job is to just make sure that keeps working. And I think it's really exciting. That's like a little bit like, you know, learning a little bit about the kind of like secret mechanics that drive the world. And so what I love about all these infrastructure stories and learning about what it takes to actually make these things work is really learning about how, you know, it turns out that there's a lot of work that goes into just making things work on a day-to-day basis.
What's the strangest place you've ever been?
So I think the strangest place was a tour I got to take recently, which is a tour of the Central Subway, which, if you're not aware of the big hubbub about it, is a tunnel that's going from the sort of Caltrain 4th and King stop all the way into Chinatown. And so I had the good opportunity of being able to take a tour, though it was only me, unfortunately. And we took a walk through this tunnel that had been dug. And it's a really strange, surreal experience because when you're walking through the tunnel, it's long enough that eventually you lose a sense of either side of the tunnel, either end of the tunnel. And you're just in this like weird infinite space that is this like perfectly consistent tunnel with like perfectly even lighting.
What did it smell like?
It smelled very, very moist. If that makes sense, because you're sort of underground and it's cold. But what's interesting is you sort of think like only a little bit above you is the whole city going on. And so, you know, the thing I was left with was this sort of interesting sense of like the city's actually really quiet once you go below a certain depth, which I thought was just a very kind of evocative experience to have.
So how has this infrastructure observatory changed the way you feel about big city projects?
Two things. One of them is, you know, particularly in San Francisco, I think where the tech mentality, unquote, right, I think is so prevalent. There's a tendency to think like, problems can be solved very quickly, right? Like, let's just hack it. Let's just like launch something. It'll work. Or if it doesn't work, we'll iterate on it, right? Those are words that you hear a lot. And, you know, there's a notion that like what worked for software on the internet will now work for everything in society. I think infrastructure is really humbling, particularly because of the reason that it's a clear example of when that doesn't work, right? You can't just hack a bridge. You can't just iterate on a bridge. Like, when the bridge goes up, the bridge has got to work. And if it doesn't, there's some real trouble. It's either going to cost millions of dollars or people are literally going to die, right? And so I think what's so fascinating, at least on that part, is sort of the long-term thinking and immense coordination that goes into making a city work or not work, for that matter. So I think that's one thing that's really changed about how I look at the city. You know, I think the second one is that local politics is not a very high participation game. And particularly around infrastructure, it's a very low participation game, in fact. What I mean by that is that infrastructure, I think a lot of people don't tend to think about a lot until it's like really obvious or really gone wrong. And I think politicians, too, have lots of incentives to not talk about it until it's too late with infrastructure, right? Because no one gets awarded for making the bridge stay up 20 more years. And so there's not a lot of interest to say, like, we need to invest in it, like, right now. There's a lot of rhetoric occasionally, but it doesn't really turn into action a whole lot of times. And so what I mean by a small group of people is that who ends up making decisions are the small group of citizens who are really, really intensely passionate about this and sort of the kind of quote-unquote experts, right? Like the people in the agencies, the urban planners. And I think that's really interesting, right? Because infrastructure ends up being something that everybody uses.
It's interesting you said that because the cement plant that makes the cement that goes into most of these infrastructure projects that you're later seeing, you know, there's lots of regulatory agencies that are, you know, trying to figure out how should this cement plant operate. And then there's probably a group of about 20 really, really active citizens who are trying to dictate how this cement is being made and what the process is. So it's not just the infrastructure. It goes back to like the things that make the infrastructure.
Right. And I think what's fun about it is that there's this great, you know, there's kind of power and boredom, if that makes sense, right? Like there's topics that people would never want to spend time on, but it turns out those decisions are really critical. And so people who are willing to focus on the really boring stuff end up wielding this like outsized amount of power in an urban center.
That was Tim Huang, the deputy director of the Bay Area Infrastructure Observatory. He spoke with KLW's Angela Johnston. The observatory has 500 registered members so far. Find out how you can join at KALW.org and click on Crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now we're going to take you into another of San Francisco's major construction projects, the Transbay Terminal. It's going up around First and Mission, south of Market Street. And if all goes according to plan, the Transbay Terminal will be a hub for 11 public transit systems, connecting people from all around the state. It's being touted as the future Grand Central Station of the West. But right now, it's a big hole in the ground, one that people have to travel around rather than through. KALW's Audrey Dilling headed inside. She brings us five surprising things she learned.
I start my quest for surprising facts 21 stories above the massive construction site. I'm in the headquarters of the Transbay Joint Powers Authority. They're the people managing this complex project. Next to me is Dennis Tershon.
I'm Dennis Tershon. I'm the senior construction manager with the Transbay Joint Power Authority.
He's also my tour guide. Below me, I can see people in hard hats, big stacks of steel beams, forklifts and cranes. And then there are the giant brown pipes crisscrossing this enormous hole in the ground.
What are those big pipes going across this hole here?
They are temporary that ultimately get removed, but as you excavate next to very tall buildings or any kind of excavation that you want to keep the sides up and, you know, and keep your integrity so you can build what you need to do in that particular excavation.
Translation, those big pipes are keeping the rest of San Francisco from falling into the construction site. So, surprising thing number one, how much you have to build just to build stuff. Tershawn says he'll show me another example of this down at ground level. But first, I need to put on a bright orange safety vest and a regulation hard hat. We head down to a narrow alley off 2nd Street. Tershawn unlocks a door in the fencing, and suddenly, I'm an insider.
So this gets a little up close and personal.
It's pretty cool.
Looking to our right, you can see all the falsework that's coming in from the bus ramp.
Falsework. That's another thing you have to build in order to build something. In this case, it's an overpass made out of wood that will be filled with concrete.
That'll eventually come to our bus deck, which is the area right above us.
Above us, steel beams rise high into the air, part of the frame of what will be a 5-level transit mecca with connections to 8 bus lines, BART, and 2 trains. The new Transbay terminal will also have a park on top that's supposed to double the amount of green space south of Market. It will be the heart of what's being called the Transbay District, complete with the new tallest building in San Francisco, the 61-story high Salesforce Tower. Take that, Transamerica Pyramid. The San Francisco Chronicle once called the old Transbay Terminal a pit of despair. But the new one will be bathed in natural light, streaming in from a dramatic skylight. Right now, though, the future Grand Central of the West looks more like a big, cluttered basement with lots and lots of rebar sticking out of it and bundles of pipes and 2x4s lying around.
All this equipment and material has to get here somehow. It's not like we're working out in the middle of nowhere.
Which leads me to surprising thing number 2. If you think the Transbay Terminal construction is getting in your way, guess what? You're kind of in its way, too. But the workers are trying to make it as painless as possible.
When it goes well, nobody knows about that planning. When something, you know, if something goes wrong, then people know you're there. The goal is to just do this and be a very good neighbor through the whole process.
And then they've got to worry about keeping all that stuff in order on the actual site.
Housekeeping is a very important element to safety and just the logistics of the project.
Like that buzzing noise you can hear right now, it's coming from a big truck that's vacuuming up dust and water.
It's kind of like cleaning up as you go, as you cook, but with a lot more at stake.
It's like cleaning up as you cook, exactly. And I like to do that. and some people don't realize the benefit of that, but it's very important when you're on a very large construction project to clean up as you go.
Surprising thing number 3, making a giant transit hub is kind of like making dinner. Kind of. It's also kind of like time travel.
You learn a lot about the history of the area when you do an excavation like this.
Surprising thing number 4. The stuff they find while they're digging.
One of the first things was the mammoth tooth.
A 13,000-year-old mammoth tooth. You can see it now at the California Academy of Sciences. They've also dug up a bunch of old wooden beams from the 30s and tons of sand from when this part of town used to be the shoreline. And the digging's not over. Phase 1 of the project is the terminal building and the bus line connections. Then comes phase 2, linking up with Caltrain and high-speed rail.
And that's all needs to be worked out in the future, because right now it's only about 35% designed.
He's talking about the rail connections, not the actual terminal. But still, surprising thing number 5, you can start building a $4.5 billion transit hub without knowing exactly how the trains will arrive. But construction manager Dennis Tershawn chooses to celebrate the small milestones. On our way out of the site, he points out one upright steel beam with a splash of color on it.
What you have in front of us right now, actually, that orange piece right there.
Tershawn says there's a tradition in construction to paint the first piece to rise above street level.
When you're a hole in the ground for 3 years, you celebrate that first piece above ground. So on November 7th, 2014, we celebrated and installed our first piece of steel above ground.
All of the pieces of the Transbay Terminal building are scheduled to be above ground and put together by 2017. That's when you'll be able to go inside without a hard hat. In San Francisco, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents. The
The Transbay Joint Powers Authority has set up a webcam where you can follow the progress of the construction yourself. Find a link at kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. And we'd like to know what big projects you want to know more about. Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by the Pine Box Boys, a San Francisco group that's been together since 2003. They're one of the acts taking part in the annual toy drive for the San Francisco Fire Department. That is happening tomorrow evening at the Great American Music Hall. Show starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
A man is born a slave, oh Lord, or a man is born a chief. I'll always be a beggar, Lord, and I'll always be a thief. Before I grow dark and old and lose my eyes to see, I'll pay back all the things I owe if you remember me. Lord, Lord, will you?